This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are singer and rapper CeeLo Green and composer, musician, and producer Danger Mouse. Together, they comprise the duo Gnarls Barkley. Their music is hard to describe. Music critic Greg Tate writes, "It sounds like an antique shop where dusty albums by Ennio Morricone, The Fifth Dimension, and Reverend C.L. Franklin, Aretha's father, are always playing on three turntables." Jody Rosen in Slate describes CeeLo as singing in the voice of the world's loneliest man. CeeLo started off as a rapper in the Atlanta-based group The Goody Mob. Danger Mouse first became known for his now-famous mashup called The Gray Album, a hybrid of the Beatles' White Album and Jay-Z's Black Album. He's also produced albums by Gorillaz, The Black Keys, and Beck. Gnarls Barkley's first album, St. Elsewhere, had the tormented-sounding hit Crazy. Their new album, The Odd Couple, has a song in that vein called Who's Gonna Save My Soul? Let's hear it.
Got some bad news this morning, which in turn made my day. When this someone spoke, I listened. All of a sudden has less and less to say. Oh, how could this be? When all this time I've lived vicariously. Who's gonna save my soul? Somebody.
That's Gnarls Barkley from the new CD, The Odd Couple.
That's a good song.
Yeah, it's a great song. Danger Mouse, CeeLo Green, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really great to have you here. This is such a kind of chilling and moving and desolate sounding song. I'm interested in your method of working together. Danger Mouse, do you do the music first? Is that the way it works?
Yeah, for the most part, that's how it's done, yeah. The music is done first, and then I'm always giving CeeLo lots of music to listen to see what he reacts to.
So CeeLo, when you heard this track, what did you like about it? Why did you choose this as the one you wanted to write a melody for? And I guess what I'm particularly interested in is usually the melody comes first, whereas when you're working, like you're writing the melody and the lyrics over an instrumental bed that's already been written. That's a very unusual way of working.
Yeah, I'd say. And although it's very solemn, you know what I'm saying, like it was still exciting because these were the first couple of things that Danger had done and was presenting to me as a new direction, you know. And what interests me lyrically is whatever lyrics or scene Danger may have had in mind as he produced, you know, the track itself. And it always makes me wonder what would he have written if he wrote the songs, you know?
Do you ask him that?
No, not directly. You know,
we don't usually talk too much about what goes into the stuff because we kind of already know by the time it comes out. We know what it came from being around each other. And so we don't really have discussions beforehand about, okay, let's do a song about this or let's do a song about that. That never happens.
So
never.
What made you think Who's Gonna Save My Soul?
Well, it was written about James Brown and it's just the loss of a hero. And so many are lost in the line of duty. And I think with heroes, of course, you know, they do know what they contribute and what they cause and something like that, but I think by default they do cause a dependency, you know what I'm saying, when I think it's a bit of their aspiration, you know, for you to believe in yourselves or believe in just other possibility. So I have to be an example, you know. I have to do it for myself.
So if this track was inspired by James Brown, And as a tribute to him after his death, I guess that explains why you were wearing a kind of James Brown wig on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, people have been associating the new sound of a record with the late 60s, you know, early 70s, you know, that era. And it's a very comfortable place to be in for us. And so it wasn't just about James Brown, but it does fit so perfectly, yeah.
CeeLo, did you know all along that you could sing like this? I mean, you got started in a hip-hop group where you basically rapped. And I think a lot of your fans were surprised by what a really soulful singer you were. I mean, did you know this all along, that you had this in you?
Yes.
Did you feel frustrated that you weren't, like, letting it out in the music that you were making on record in quite this way?
I did. But at the time, I just felt like, you know, first things first. I thought that the ability or the aspiration was probably not in vain, you know, and I had always felt very purposed, and there was a point to me having, you know, these attributes or these feelings or these notions, these impulses, you know, so these inner visions, so to speak. I felt like we conveyed just as much soul, you know, hip-hop-wise with Goody Mob and so on and so forth, but with emceeing, it's a lot more limiting, you know what I mean, the things that you can do. And I always say that with melody and harmony, it's much more infinite possibility. You can stretch it and twist it and turn it and bend it into so many other shapes and fashions, you know, and which is just a lot more gratifying for me as an artist.
Well, we just heard Who's Gonna Save My Soul. I want to contrast that with one of the more kind of, you know, upbeat, really lively tracks on the new CD. So I thought we'd hear Charity Case. So let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk about it. So this is the opening track from the new Gnarls Barkley CD, The Odd Couple.
Moment, but that's all that matters to me. How are
Charity Case, the opening track from the new Gnarls Barkley CD, The Odd Couple. And my guests are CeeLo Green and Danger Mouse, the duo of Gnarls Barkley. I guess one of the things I really like about Gnarls Barkley is the layers of sound and how many different things are going on in a track. And I guess, Danger Mouse, I'm wondering how you started hearing and thinking that way, in that kind of multi-layered way.
It's kind of when you don't, I don't know a whole lot about music theory, and I think that when you don't know the shortcuts to things and you have to take the long way, there's some interesting stuff along the way that happens, a lot of happy accidents. So in order for me to make something sound what I think is passable as, you know, competent music, I have to really take the long way myself. So I wind up layering things over and over and over again, kind of to cover up my playing or cover up my limitation. You know, I've been messing around a lot on drums recently, been trying to anyway, but all you need is a good loop and you're okay. And then, you know, I dabble around bass and keyboards and organs and all that kind of stuff. So, and I've always been into kind of music that sounds visual. And I think that with a lot of layers, it kind of complements you to kind of think in your own head and have your own vision for something, as opposed to picturing the people playing any one instrument. You know, I don't want somebody to picture somebody playing any one particular instrument. I want them to have their own kind of dream or their own kind of vision for any kind of music that they hear.
So what was the music that inspired you early on?
To actually start making music was when I started getting into, I guess, what people would call classic rock stuff. The Beatles, Pink Floyd, Jimi Hendrix, stuff like that. Just stuff that I had never really, I didn't grow up with that kind of music around me. I grew up more with Motown and 80s pop and hip-hop, basically. And so when I heard this stuff, it was really kind of new to me. And it made a lot of the other music I had been listening to make a lot more sense as well.
What did you hear in it that you hadn't heard before?
That's a there's no simple answer to that. It was just a whole world, really. But more than anything, I saw how closed off I had been, how purposely closed off I had been, because it would have been really different for me to listen to that kind of music in the environment that I was in at the time. And it just showed, the music was the main thing that showed me how much I needed to really break out of trying to be like everybody else.
So what was the environment that you were in that music you were listening to wouldn't have fit into?
A similar one, I think, as CeeLo. We both grew up in Atlanta, in metro Atlanta. And, you know, we went to predominantly black schools, and we listened to mostly hip-hop and booty shake and whatever our parents played, really.
Danger, did growing up in a period where a lot of hip-hop artists were sampling music make you hear music, do you think, in a different way than you might otherwise have, of hearing like music broken down to like discrete elements, to fragments that,
sure,
and then
sure.
make you think that you could create fragments and sample fragments and build them into a whole that was completely different than the fragments?
Sure. I mean, it's just like, you know, I was in the bathroom the other day looking at a picture, and I saw something in the picture that looked like a certain kind of face, and it was a child's face the way it was looking, but when you back away from it, it's not that at all. It was just a tree branch, you know, and the arm of a bear or something like that. But what I saw was that, and if I took that little piece and made a big picture out of it, then it would be the way I looked at it or what I saw that was beautiful about it or nice about it or whatever. And with music, it's a similar thing for me when it comes to sampling. I just want to work with stuff that's affecting me, and I never... It's not really my concern to kind of try to be the best guitar player or instrument player or anything like that. There's plenty of people who are great at that, and that's not going to be anything that would be, you know, that I could do anything with that would change anything. So I think for me with sampling, it's just about shamelessly finding something that you love and trying to make something new that other people will love out of it as well, that has a little bit of you in it. But, I mean, early on when you're making music, it can be difficult to judge yourself. And that was my way of, I guess, being able to kind of, whether it's judging or producing or whatever, was to start out with messing around with stuff that I knew was already pretty great.
Now, you were both born in the 70s. CeeLo, you spent all your childhood and early years in Atlanta and still live there. And... I read that your parents were both ministers, is that right?
Yes.
So did you grow up singing a lot in church?
Well, I didn't always sing, my father passed away when I was very young. I think I was about two when he passed, so I don't remember us going to church together, but I'm sure we did. I didn't really sing, but there was an awful lot of religion and spirit, you know, in my childhood.
I'm surprised to hear you didn't sing.
I used to be shy to sing. So my aunt, who is a vocalist as well, she was a singer at, I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but it's called Aunt Fanny's Cabin here in Atlanta somewhere. And she overheard me singing in the shower one day, and she kind of encouraged me to. She said, "You got a nice voice," or whatever. But my stepfather used to play Jackie Wilson when I was young, and I was just telling somebody this story the other day of how I learned that I could sing by emulating and imitating the music that I adored, and then my voice would become at a point would become flush with Jackie's, to where I could distinguish his voice from mine, and I could emulate each riff and inflection. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, and so I think that's how I essentially learned how to sing. You know, now learning to be myself, you know, so like it's a whole other story.
I want to play another track from the new Norris Barkley CD, and this is called Surprise. Could you tell us what you were thinking about when you put it together?
Yeah. One of the big purposes is with Norris is, to me, is to make something that doesn't sound, that's not very easily definable and has a certain sound to it. And for me, the best way that I've been able to do that is to mess around with a bunch of new music and old music, stuff that was recorded in studios 40 years ago with all kinds of different mic setups and everything, and then do the same thing and then mix that with something that's been brand new, and you're going to get a sound that you can't really plan or that can't be really copied in its own way. So it's to get a really, really distinct, individual, and very different sound. That's the way I found to do that, especially when you have a voice like his.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we wanted to set up some old session players and make a soul record, that'd be fine, but I don't think that would really do much except for show off.
Celia, you want to talk about writing the lyric for Surprise?
Well, yeah, I do. I think I just know danger in that way, and I do. There's always this bittersweet melancholy, you know, tension around it, you know, and it is beautiful, and it is encouraging, but then again it's there's a sadness to it too, and so therefore ultimately it is to be able to smile and to sing in the face of adversity, you know what I mean? But don't be surprised when adversity comes to challenge you.
Okay, well, let's hear Surprise from the new Gnarls Barkley record, which is called The Odd Couple. That's Surprise from the new Gnarls Barkley record, The Odd Couple. My guests are CeeLo Green and Danger Mouse of Gnarls Barkley. It's really a great track.
I like that one, too.
Danger, I'm wondering, you know, a lot of people knew you from the Grey album before they knew Gnarls Barkley. And the Grey album, for anybody who doesn't know, is your mashup, your combining of the Beatles' White Album and Jay-Z's Black Album.
Yeah.
And how do you think that affected perceptions of who you are as an artist?
I think that for me, I've had a lot of work to change that. You know, I was already a few songs in with CeeLo on the Gnarls stuff before I even did that record.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it was something that kind of was a quick little detour in what I was trying to do, but I think it's still a little bit early to tell. It's been a few years now, but I don't know if it's had the right effect that I was looking for or not, but I definitely had a purpose for why I did it. But
which was what?
Well, originally it was a couple of things. It was definitely an art project to kind of see what I could do with sampling, but at the same time it was kind of to show, it was a lot of things actually, but it was really to kind of to show how two seemingly very different things could fit together, both black and white, both, you know, musically, and a lot of those things. And, you know, I wanted to play it for my parents. I wanted to play it for certain friends who I know didn't like hip-hop, certain friends I know didn't like or know or care about the Beatles. And I wanted to at least, you know, present it in that kind of way to make people think twice about what they think they already know. And that was what the idea was. And it obviously right. got turned into a lot of other copyright and all this other crap. But that was never really the intention for me.
Danger Mouse and CeeLo Green. Their duo Gnarls Barkley has a new CD called The Odd Couple. You can hear two tracks from it on our website, freshair.npr. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his novel Breakpoint, Richard Clarke imagines a world where cyber criminals hack into the software for communication satellites and send them careening off into space and blow up fiber optic cables, shutting down most of the nation's internet traffic. Clarke says the story is fiction, but not so far-fetched. When Clarke was at the White House as National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism, it was his job in part to imagine threats to national security. One of the things Clarke has focused on since leaving the government in 2003 is the vulnerability of the nation's critical computer networks to cybercriminals, terrorists, and even foreign powers. It's one of the topics addressed in his new book, Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke to Richard Clarke.
Well, Richard Clarke, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, you've written about how many critical computer networks in both the government and private industry and in utilities that serve, you know, millions of people are vulnerable to attack and tampering. And when you were in the White House, you know, in the 90s, late 90s, of course, you had to deal with some of these issues. And I thought I would ask you to describe one of these episodes that showed how vulnerable even highly sensitive computer networks in the government can be. There was an security exercise that you engineered called Eligible Receiver, I think, in 1997. Well, describe that, if you will.
In 1997 is really sort of still early days of the information technology revolutions, early days of cyberspace. But already most of the government, most of the Pentagon had been wired and was depending on the internet and on cyberspace for command and control of our weapon systems, as well as for everything else. And we wanted to begin then to test and see if it was possible to hack into any of these systems. And so with the permission of the Secretary of Defense and review from a great number of lawyers, we put together a team largely consisting of hackers from the National Security Agency. And with no one else in the Pentagon, aside from one or two people at the top, knowing about it, they began on a Sunday, I believe, to try to hack their way into some network somewhere in the Pentagon. And we were going to do this for a week and then report back on how well we did. And within, I think, 24 or 48 hours, not only had they hacked their way into some network, they had hacked their way into all networks they could find in the Pentagon, including the command and control network. And so we stopped it right then and there. We didn't run it for the week. And we reported out to the Deputy Secretary of Defense. He then said, well, what can we do? And the best technology that was available back then, and this is over 10 years ago, was something called an intrusion detection system. It was a box, essentially, that you put on your network, and it sent out a little alarm email anytime it thought somebody was trying to get into the network in an unorthodox way. And so we said, we think you should buy these things and put them on the networks. And about 6 months later, we came back, and we met with the head of the Army and the head of the Air Force and the head of the Navy to see how their systems were doing. And one of these guys, I think it was the head of the Army, said, well, it's terrible. You know, you've made us put these intrusion detection systems on our network. Before we had them on our network, nobody ever attacked us. Now that you have put these boxes on our network, they're going off all the time and people are attacking us all the time.
So he was assuming that they were being left alone when what was actually happening was they were being attacked silently.
Ignorance is bliss.
Oh. Well, the fact that NSA, National Security Agency hackers, were able to get into these sensitive Pentagon computer networks, did that indicate that other hackers might already have been in them and doing some mischief?
It did, because the NSA hackers did not have any insider knowledge, and they weren't using any classified tricks. one of the rules for that exercise 10 years ago was we could only use techniques that we found available on the internet itself. So techniques that hackers were already talking about to each other in chat rooms. In other words, very low-level, publicly available attack tools. And what's happened in the 10 years since is enormous in terms of two things. One, our dependence on computer networks. And two, the ability of hackers, including terrorist groups and governments, to get in to networks. What hasn't changed is how bad our defenses are.
Now, I think you mentioned in the book that even computer networks operated by the Joint Chiefs of Staff appear to have been penetrated by hackers. Is there any evidence that they caused damage?
Well, a lot of this is still classified, and the Pentagon is reluctant to say what's happened to them. They don't want people to know. But one thing became clear last year when the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, had to admit that his own front office, his own office computer system, was not only compromised, but compromised by an attack from the government of China. It was about the same time that the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, was also hacked by the government of China. At the end of 2007, the British Domestic Security Service, MI5, sent out a classified note to 300 companies, the 300 largest companies in the United Kingdom, private companies. And the classified note said, "You should assume that the Chinese government has hacked its way into your networks and knows everything on them."
Now, what were the Chinese doing in the Secretary of Defense's computers? Do we know? And were they confronted about this?
Well, they of course, deny it. And it's easy to deny these things because people can trace back attacks only so far. And it's always possible that the attacks originated somewhere else. Let me give you an example. When I was in the White House, I came into work one day and they told me, China, this was back in about the year 2000, China tried to attack our White House internet site last night. And before I accepted that, I said, well, what do you mean China? The government of China? Who in the government of China? Tell me more. Show me the traceback. And when they did the traceback completely, they found out that, yes, the attack had come through the Chinese telephone switch, China Telecoms, but the attack had originated in Washington State. So I mean, you always have to be careful about saying you know who did it if you haven't traced it all the way back. And people can assume names on the internet. They can assume anonymity. They can spoof addresses. But I think it's pretty clear that in the attacks in 2007 that we were talking about, it was the Chinese government. Now, were they doing it as a training exercise for their cyber attack force, which they have? They have a cyber attack force in the military. Were they doing it just to send us a signal? The signal could be, remember that if you mess with us in any significant way, we will always be able to get back at you. Or was it somebody else altogether? I don't know. I think it was the Chinese government.
Well, Richard Clark, when President Clinton asked you to look into the cyber terror, which I know is a term that you don't prefer, but the vulnerabilities of computer networks, one of the things that you did was to contact the CEOs of a lot of the large computer software and hardware companies. What did you find about their level of awareness of the issue and their awareness of vulnerabilities in their own hardware and systems?
Well, what I found was that the manufacturers of software and hardware, even the giant companies worth hundreds of billions of dollars, they only do one little thing that's necessary for cyberspace to work. So Microsoft makes software, most of it for games, some of it for offices, and they make operating systems for laptops and desktops. That's a very small piece of all of the things that are necessary for cyberspace to work. And that's all that they really know. Another giant in the industry is Cisco. And while most consumers don't know about Cisco, Cisco's a huge internet company. that makes basically one thing, and that is routers, which are the switches that move the little electrons and make the internet work. And you can find this all the way across the industry. There are all of these small little niches that companies perform. None of them are fully aware of all of the components necessary to make cyberspace work. And so there's no overall accountability, there's no overall responsibility, and there's no one designing the entire system to be secure. And so when you go to talk to a CEO of a big software company or a CEO of a big router manufacturing company, you'll be lucky if they really understand their own company, let alone the problems of cyberspace and how all of these things interact. The software is really usually the problem. Software is code written by human beings. And all of the studies that we have done indicate that human beings who write code, even those bright MIT geeks, make a lot of mistakes. And why is that a problem? Because if you can find those mistakes, some of them, some of the encoding mistakes in software, then you can get the software to do things that it's not supposed to do, like let you into a network that's supposedly secret.
Speaking of China's efforts at cyber penetration, you have to tell the story about the digital picture frames.
Well, this, I think, is the tip of the iceberg. But it occurred earlier this year that you could go to a large chain store in the United States, I believe it was Best Buy, and buy one of these nice Christmas presents, which is a picture frame, a physical picture frame, but you can download from your computer into the picture frame lots of pictures, 100 pictures or more. And then you can fix it so that every 5 seconds or 10 seconds or 30 seconds, the picture that appears in the picture frame on your desk changes. That's very nice. Now, the problem was it was made in China, as so many pieces of technology are these days. And when you took it and plugged it into your computer so that you could download pictures from your computer to the picture frame, meanwhile, the picture frame was doing something on its own. It was uploading into your computer a little stealth tool that ran around your computer looking for passwords, looking for credit card numbers, looking for any little piece of information that had any value, and then took over your email program without your being able to detect it and emailed all of that information back to a site in China.
I'm getting now, chills here.
if they're doing that with consumer picture frames, imagine what else they're doing.
Well, now, all right, so what happens here? Whether it's the government of China or not, they've gotten into my computer, they've taken all of my passwords and my pathetically boring email. What do they do with it? What do they want with it?
Well, your computer, my computer, everyone's computer, may be what's called in the hacker trade a zombie. And that sounds very frightening. But here's what a zombie is. Somehow they get into your computer and they set up an operation inside your computer that is not visible on your screen. You'll never know that there's something happening. Your computer may slow down a little bit. You don't know why. You may not notice it at all. But in the background, their little program is doing whatever it is that they want it to do. When you get 100,000 computers that are compromised like that, you know, grandma's computer and school computers and all sorts of library computers that aren't well secured, you get 100,000 of them relatively quickly. Now you've got all of that computing power at your command. You can take 100,000 computers on the network and direct their signals all at once to one switch, overloading that switch and knocking things off the internet. That's called a distributed denial of service attack. So sometimes when they're taking over computers, it's not to get your password, certainly not to read your email, or maybe not even to get your credit card number. Maybe it's the hackers just want to add another zombie so that they have this massive number of computers under their control to do whatever they want.
Well, in the case of these picture frames manufactured in China that were discovered to have this stealth software designed to get into your home computer. What was discovered about the perpetrator of that attack, and what were the consequences?
Well, nothing was ever discovered about who did it. The only thing that could be discovered was where the material that was stolen from your computer was sent. And it was sent to a site in China, and China, of course, is investigating the case.
Hmm. We're speaking with Richard Clark. He was the National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism in the White House during the Clinton and Bush administrations. His latest book is Your Government Failed You. When you were in the White House working on cybersecurity issues, you assembled a conference including information technology executives and experts, but also a guy called Mudge, M-U-D-G-E. Explain who he was and what his role was.
Well, he is now a well-respected ethical hacker, a white hat hacker, working for a company in Boston. But at the time, when he was a lot younger, he had a regular boring day job. And he and a bunch of friends who were very computer literate, who all had boring day jobs, rented a place called The Loft outside of Boston and went around looking in dumpsters at electronics companies and taking computers that people were throwing away and playing with them and getting them to work and getting them to work better than they were ever intended to work. And soon these dozen guys had a massive computer capability. And they began investigating on their own, just for fun, to see what the mistakes were, what the vulnerabilities were in the Internet. And the FBI used them off the record, informally, when the FBI had questions related to the Internet.
So what these hackers do that are, as you say, white hat hackers, is they discover vulnerabilities in software and hardware, and then they communicate that, to the manufacturers, right, to the government. And then if it's not fixed, what do?
They give the manufacturers a certain amount of time, depending upon what the mistake is that they discover and what vulnerabilities it opens up. But after a while, if the manufacturer doesn't do anything about it, they will tell the world about the mistake, the vulnerability, by posting it in one of these chat rooms on the Internet. And that creates problems because then bad guy hackers will immediately learn about the vulnerability, and they will then write what's called an exploit, a program to use this mistake that the hackers have discovered to attack computer programs.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Richard Clark. He was the former National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism in the Bush and Clinton White Houses. He's written a novel called Breakpoint, and his latest book about weaknesses in the nation's national security efforts is called Your Government Failed You. I wanted to talk about some of the specific threats that may be out there, and part of this comes from the novel that you wrote, Breakpoint. It begins with a scene in which there is a series of explosions aimed at points on the shorelines of the United States at which fiber optic cables leave the ocean and enter, I guess, land sites where there are these, in effect, unsecured buildings that are vulnerable to attack. Is this the way it is in real life?
Yeah, unfortunately it is. When I first started worrying about Internet security for the White House, I said to my team, I want to go see the Internet. And they all had a good chuckle and said, you know, you're silly guy. You can't see the Internet. It's a virtual thing. It's in cyberspace. I said, no, wait a minute. It's got to have some manifestations in the real world that we can go out and touch and kick the tires. And it does. So the Internet runs up your street, underneath the street in a fiber optic cable. It goes into buildings all around your community where there are switches. There are physical manifestations of it, and you can attack those physical manifestations. When you write an email to somebody in London, it doesn't most of the time bounce off a satellite. It runs down the street, and then it runs out to the Jersey Shore and through a little building on the beach, and then under the water in a cable, not unlike the telegraph cables from 150 years ago, except these are fiber optic cables. They have a lot more capability. But if you cut those physical manifestations of the internet, as 9/11 did in New York, by the way. Lower Manhattan was cut off from cyberspace, and the stock market, the trading floors couldn't trade. And one of the reasons it took so long to reopen the stock market after the 9/11 attack was that the stock market couldn't communicate with anybody.
And I know there was an incident recently, and I forget exactly where it's believed a ship anchor in the Middle East somewhere had gone astray and damaged a cable. Is there a movement to provide more security to these? No,
there isn't. The theory is that there's so much fiber optic capability around that there's redundancy, and therefore if you lose something here or there, you can reroute around it. Well, that's true. And then you have choke points where it all comes together, where at the end of the day, all of those fiber lines have to go to the New York stock market somewhere or other facilities like that. And so it is possible to do damage to cyberspace through physical attacks. Again, the point here is we are so dependent upon cyberspace that if somebody knocks it out, intentionally or otherwise, whether that person is a government or a criminal or somebody having fun, if they knock out certain kinds of cyberspace, we lose control of our military, we lose control of our banks, we lose control of our airlines, our air traffic control system. We are very, very vulnerable to someone doing damage in cyberspace.
There was a headline last October from a publication called The Register, which said Richard Clark, former security czar, calls for closed internet. Now, what are they getting wrong about what you're proposing?
They're not getting anything wrong. I believe there are certain functions that shouldn't be done on what we call the public internet. You know, should the Pentagon's command and control system be on the public internet? Well, it's not. We've moved it into a private network, where actually the fiber and the routers and everything else is, we think, separate from the other internet. Well, there are lots of other things that perhaps should be on private systems, like the command and control for the electric power grid, like perhaps medical records and hospital control systems, the air traffic control system. Why should the digits running the air traffic control system be running down the same fiber that your Amazon book order is running, or your email to your mother? It shouldn't be on the same internet. They should be totally physically separated.
So this would be, in effect, a completely different secure set of hardware, which you don't have any anonymous traffic on.
A set both of hardware, of switches, of routers, and of the fiber optic connecting them, so that there is no physical connection between the internet and these control systems. Now, that exists today for the Pentagon, for some intelligence agencies, for some very large companies. But I think the kind of sensitive functions that we're talking about, banking, the stock market, the electric power grid, other things like that, just shouldn't have anything to do with an internet that anybody anywhere in the world can get into.
Now, there have been plans developed by the federal government to increase cybersecurity. There was a national strategy to secure cyberspace signed by the president in 2003. And then I think another initiative authorized earlier this year. Give me your sense of those efforts and how effective they've been.
Well, the strategy was developed painstakingly with a lot of public input from universities and from corporations and from experts around the country. And it was given to President Bush in February of 2003, and he thanked everybody for the effort and I think promptly threw it in the trash barrel. Nothing happened until 2007 when they began to be aware that the Chinese government was hacking into sensitive sites in the Defense Department and in defense industries. And then in January of this year, the president signed off on a new initiative backed up by many, many billions of dollars to try initially to protect government computer networks and to do research on new ways of protecting cyberspace.
And it sounds like what you're saying now is a large and expensive effort to just develop, in effect, a separate and secure system for these critical functions.
Well, that's what I'm proposing, and I think the government is looking at that for some functions, but no one's actually doing it for things like the electric power grid.
Well, Richard Clark, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Richard Clark speaking with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Clark is a former White House National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism. His new book is called Your Government Failed You, Breaking the Cycle of National Security Disasters. Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News.